I don't know. Duck and cover, bitches.
I had a little bird. Its name was Enza. I opened the window and in flew Enza.
Wow. Obey the laws and wear the gauze. Protect your jaws from septic paws. Ew.
No. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hello.
How's everyone doing?
Hello, fans. All three of you.
All three.
All of our super fans.
Yes.
What's up? What's up? This is a Particularly Dangerous Situation podcast.
I'm sure you missed us, right? I mean,
totally.
Probably listen to our very important last episode that happened to come out on April 1st.
Bonus.
Yeah, it was a nice little bonus episode for y'all, which is great because this one's probably going to be a little bit behind schedule, but that's okay because you got a bonus.
Yeah.
So that's holding you over.
Yeah. So this is Bree right there.
Hi, I'm Bree, and that's Brett over there.
Hi, y'all. We're sitting over here and over there because like we're literally apart, as you guys probably already know if you've heard our other podcasts. We record using Zoom, so we are not close to each other. We are practicing social distancing.
Yes, which we were practicing before with each other because we live in different areas.
We're always socially distant. So you guys, you started off with a little bit of a rhyme sesh there.
You dig that, y'all?
Yeah. Did you like it? Because guess what we're talking about today? Dun, 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 Brie?
The 1918 flu pandemic, also known as AKA the Spanish flu.
Dun, dun, dun.
Which I don't like saying the Spanish flu because we'll find out why later. But yeah.
Nobody does. But, you know, what are you going to do? So we could just say it, 1918 flu pandemic, if it makes everybody feel better. But we're not making any connections to our current pandemic. We know that nobody wants to hear those dreaded words. So we're going to try and avoid it to the best of our ability. But we don't forbid you or say, you know, you can't make any connections on your own. So just go for it if you want to. Do what you will. Go ahead and grab a drink and sit your butt down and get ready for a wild ride, babes. Because I'm drinking tequila.
This is one of the, I guess, technically second time that we've done this. So we're both covering the same item on purpose. The last time was when we did a bonus episode on winter storms.
Correct.
Like safety, emergency stuff. So we decided to do this episode. You could say inspired / dedicated to This Podcast Will Kill You. They have a great, their first episode of their podcast goes over the flu in general.
I love
Me
them.
Me too.
They're amazing.
So good.
Two epidemiology students, now I believe full-on epidemiologists, with the same first name, and we love them. And their very, very first episode was on influenza, and they came up with quarantinis and the placeboritas, and I absolutely love them. They've got a great banter, as all other podcasts do, and they're just awesome. They're full of
information. They're so smart.
Yes.
The little smarties.
God, we love you girls. You're amazing.
We do. So yeah, that was actually one of our references. But for this episode, I saved all the references for the end since, and Brett, we created an outline. So
guys, we're getting organized. It's like,
what
crazy.
Is this? Don't expect this again unless we both cover a big thing.
this is a one-off.
Yeah, exactly. It's a special, special thing. All right.
Special
episode. Brett. Are you ready to start us off?
I'm gonna just jump right in here, okay?
Hell yeah.
So we did our best in this outline to kind of make it a little, not really timeliney, but kind of bullet marking the more important points of all of this. So here we go. Spanish flu, as it's been known to be called, or the flu of 1918, was estimated to have killed more people in 24 weeks than AIDS killed in 24 years. More in 1 year than the Black Death did in a whole century. That's 100 years, people. Okay.
That's crazy.
100 years. And this was like a year-long flu. A little over a year. All right. So when it first appeared in early March of 1918, there is documentation that it did start as far back as 1917, but there's no clear connection quite yet. I know it's always being researched. They're always going back to these original pandemics to prepare themselves for future pandemics. Yeah, there's no definitive proof. So the first definitive proof we have is 1918 in March. It had all the hallmarks of a seasonal flu, but it was highly contagious. I've already had too much tequila. And a very, an especially virulent strain. One of the first registered cases, and this wasn't done very often. So I'm sure all of you know who have actually done research on Spanish flu have found that the numbers differ greatly. It's because they don't have really good true documentation because of how long ago this occurred and how fast it occurred. One of the first registered cases was Albert Gitchell, a U.S. Army cook at Camp Funston, not to be confused with Fort Funston here in California, which is a dog park or a dog beach, which I absolutely love. But Camp Funston is in Kansas, and he was hospitalized with 104-degree fever. It spread quickly throughout the Army installation down there, and it was home to 54,000 troops. So by the end of the month, 1,100 troops had been hospitalized, and 38 of those had died after developing pneumonia. Similar to most of these HN flus, and I think I could be wrong about this, but I believe that Aaron's kind of described it, is that usually secondary infections are the bigger problem. Okay. So the pneumonia that was developed as they developed this flu was the one that was the killer. As U.S. troops were deployed en masse for the war effort, because at this time, ladies and gentlemen, if you didn't know it, we are right smack in the middle of World War I. In an effort to get them over to Europe, they carried the flu with them. And these guys are traveling in close quarters, packed ships. They're staying in bunkers together. They're staying in rooms together. They're so closely, you know, and that's like a big hallmark, of course, all of us know, is that most flus are transmitted by close contact. So big issue. Throughout April and May, the virus spread like wildfire throughout England, France, Spain, and Italy. An estimated 3/4 of the French military was infected in the spring of 1918, and as many as half of British troops. So I think a lot of people don't really, I don't know if, you know, this is something you agree with, Brie, but I feel like flu is more commonly associated with fall and winter.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so I would agree.
This is what makes me think that there was some kind of something going on in 1917. This is me personally drawing that kind of conclusion. So luckily, the first wave of the virus wasn't particularly deadly, with symptoms like high fever and malaise usually lasting only 3 to 4 days, but the mortality rates were similar to a seasonal flu. So again, if all of you have been doing the research with the current pandemic, you're realizing that flu takes out more lives on an annual basis than what this current pandemic is doing. So far. So they were just like, oh, it's just another flu year. It just really happened to pass very quickly when we were at war because of this conditions, yada, yada, yada. So just as the war affected the course of the influenza affected the course of the war. There's a Ohio State historian named James Harris. He believed the rapid spread of the Spanish flu in the fall was at least partially to blame on public health officials unwilling to impose quarantines during wartime, which I don't want to say I agree with it, but at the time, I understand it. You're at war. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You need soldiers. You draft people. You do your thing. And I think at the time, they were like, well, it's flu, so just be extra careful. You know? So there's people walking outside noticing that I'm recording. This is hilarious because I have my windows open.
Oh, that's funny.
Or my blinds are open so people can see me.
Don't worry, okay, guys. We're just talking about flu. That's
it's all good. It's all good. I got this.
This is normal.
So the public health response to the crisis in the United States was further hampered by a severe nursing shortage. Again, making draw your own correlations, people. As thousands of nurses had been deployed to military camps and the front lines. So because they're out there fighting a war, they can't be here taking care of sick people. The shortage was worsened by the American Red Cross's refusal to train African-American nurses until the worst part of the pandemic had already passed. And again, this is going on at a time where segregation was still a thing. It was, you know, I feel like it was still close enough where we still had, you know, the South was the South and the North was the North, and they just weren't, you know, introducing black doctors and nurses into the mainstream.
100%. I mean, it's 102 years ago.
Exactly. You know, and it's like even what was until the 50s or 60s where segregation was not really an issue anymore.
Which, yeah, that's a whole other thing that we could go.
We say that.
Yeah. There's different types of ways that segregation still happens today. and after the 60s. But that's, I mean, you, people have heard us talk about that and Vanport and stuff. So that's a conversation for another time, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. But it didn't make it about matters any better.
So exactly. This is worse. Like, this is more
way direct. Worse. Yeah.
Yeah.
Besides the properties of the virus itself, which we'll get into shortly.
Woohoo!
Many additional factors contributed to the virulence. I think it's
virulence. I think
Of the 1918 pandemic. In 1918, the world was still engaged in World War One. Movement and mobilization as troops, as I said, caused a number of close contacts. Living spaces were overcrowded. Health services were limited, and up to 30% of U.S. physicians were deployed for military service. So it didn't make it completely like it was an issue. There was general and military compliance that was very sparse. So a lot of times people would be like, "Hey, don't be in close quarters," but you're like, "Well, I'm in the military. I can help it. I just got to sleep on top of this guy." You know what I mean? So it was just one of those things. And then at home, of course, they would tell people, you know, don't do this, do this, do this. But there wasn't anything of this nature that had been so virulent before. So compliance was not an easy thing for people to sort of grasp. Okay. Mm-hmm. I do remember reading that people were dying because they couldn't get food delivered because people were afraid to get close or kiss or embrace. There was no intimacy. So a lot of things that were going on, you know, society itself had begun to sort of fray, so much so that scientists who were in charge of the Armed Forces Division of Communication Disease worried that if the pandemic continued accelerating for a few more weeks, civilization could disappear from the face of the earth. So they were starting to say things like that, like, look, do you want to be extinct? You know, so it puts fear of God in people, which is fine. But I think, you know, if you did something like that today, people could go into extreme panic. Back then, people were just, they felt like they were mildly inconvenienced and they're like, okay, I guess we have to, you know what I mean? So, and I also have documentation just in general that the particular flu lasted from 1918 to 1920. So the last few cases petered out in 1920. I did also read, just before I jumped on this meeting, that the second, which I'll get into later, but the second wave was worse. But the second wave, they think that it petered out the way it did with the third wave because the people who passed away with that particularly virulent strain. So it wasn't passed on.
So interesting. Okay.
The dying of people was actually beneficial to this particular strain petering out the way it did.
Which is hard to say when you're talking about people, but I get it. Yeah.
I know. It sounds awful, but it's just like, you know, it's the nature of illness and, you know, it is what it is. So I'm going to turn it over to Bree for some scientific facts.
All right. So please excuse the pronunciation of these words because I'm doing the sciencey, let's dive into it. And you'll see.
I did this on purpose.
So, because you enjoy it so much. I know the truth. So hang in there with me. Yeah. Okay. So the symptoms of this flu were extreme pain, cyanosis, I believe is how you say it. That's like blue skin. That's from the lack of oxygen that happens. Bleeding mucous membrane. So that would cause nose bleeds. And sometimes squirting is what I read from different mucous areas, I guess. All your internal organs would be, I guess, like mucous membranes. So you'd have drainage from the brain tissue. And
which is weird
inside.
Because as the Aarons mentioned in the first episode, they said the brain is like encased in a liquid. If that is not there, that is a severe problem.
Yeah. Oh, so gross. Torn muscles from coughing. The lungs look like the mnemonic plague.
Yes.
So hard to say because I want to say bubonic too. Yeah. Which was one of the three types of the plagues that went through. It's the one that really fucked up your lungs. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the grossest ones. Accumulation of pockets of air under the skin.
Oh, no.
So this meant skin would crackle like Rice Krispies, as Aaron explained it. I kind of thought of it as bubble wrap, I'm assuming. Yeah. And it was like, oh,
we're
no.
Both of a very sick mind that if we had somebody that was this sick in our house, we'd be like, pop, pop, pop.
Sorry, I'm just so, I just can't.
Sorry,
it's
can't.
Just there.
I have a problem. I've got an obsession and it's a problem.
So to kind of put that together, this was from one of the resources that we talk about below that Brett sent me. That's patients with the influenza disease of the epidemic were generally characterized by common complaints associated with the flu. They had body aches, muscle and joint pain, headache, sore throat, and an unproductive cough with an occasionally harsh breathing. The most common sign of infection was the fever, which ranged from 100 to 104 Fahrenheit and lasted for a few days. The onset of the epidemic influenza was particularly sudden as people or peculiarly sudden. Sorry, my podcast name went in, you know, yeah, that happens.
Particularly.
was peculiarly sudden as people were struck down with dizziness and weakness and pain while on duty or in the street. So you'd be walking all of a sudden and be like, why is things spinning? What's happening? I didn't drink today. Yeah. Exactly. Really? Oh, that sounded really good at the mic with them. Like, thanks. There. After the disease was established, the mucous membranes became reddened with sneezing. And in some cases, there were hemorrhages of mucous membranes of the nose, and bloody noses were commonly seen. So vomiting occurred on occasion and also sometimes diarrhea, but more commonly was the constipation.
Interesting.
Very similar to the flu. The reason why the next part I have on here is talking about different types of flu, because people like to use the verbiage, it's just the flu, which I don't agree with it just being the flu.
Yeah.
Especially because there's not just a flu, like right away.
There's so many flus.
Yeah. So there's different types of flus, and then those have different types of strains of those flus.
Correct.
Or different properties and different versions of that flu.
Right.
So there's four that I'll be listing, which is A, B, C, and D. But then there's different versions of influenza A, different versions of influenza B, and they all have different infectiousness and
virulence.
Yeah. Which virulence is the severity or harmfulness of the disease. So it's like, how strong is it to fucking kill you?
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. So the way that these are specified, like different types of flus, is species of origin, and if it's isolated in an animal, geographical origin, strain number, and year of isolation. So you will see some flus say something like that, which I mentioned when it's one point, where it'll be SW/IOS/30/something. So that's how some of the strains are done. You can see on one of the resources we have here, you can see a whole list of them. That's really
I mean, that's how we came up with SARS and coronavirus and all those different MERS and whatnot. They have specific names. Each letter means something, and that particular letter is usually associated with a number as well, like H1N1.
Is even further. So H1N1, I'll be going into what the H and N mean, but this is even further. So
just drill down even more. Okay.
Yeah. So this is, for example, so I think it's the one that I see where it's like SW. So that's the species of origins, and then /Iowa. So the geographic origins, Iowa /30. So it's strain number 30/whatever year.
Crazy.
So yeah, so they have, and that's more of like the specific strain that they're talking of. Within. Okay. So it'll be like influenza A, something, something, something.
Okay, that makes sense.
So influenza A can be found in many species, including humans, birds, and pigs. And due to the breadth of potential hosts, which is like the variety, the amount, and its ability to genetically change over a short amount of time, influenza A viruses are very diverse and they're capable of causing a pandemic. This happens when a virus that's significantly different from circulating influenza A strains emerges. Okay. So the 1918 pandemic was an influenza A flu. So then there's influenza B, which typically only found in humans. Influenza C, which is mainly occurs in humans, but has been known to occur in dogs and pigs. Right? So weird. And then influenza D is found mainly in cattle, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC.
Ooh, is that related to mad cow, I wonder?
No, because that's a protein. Well, I mean, there's a protein, but mad cow is a protein that, like, eats the brain, essentially.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. So totally different disease.
Mad cow happens from cannibalism, essentially, like cows eating cows. And one of the cows having it. I mean, that's a whole nother thing that it's so fascinating. Mad cow.
So crazy.
Yeah. I think the Aaron's do an episode on that too in this podcast.
Good job, girls.
So it's not known to infect or cause illnesses in humans for D.
Okay.
So to go down what a virus is. So a virus is little bundles of genetic material surrounded by protein. So it's just imagine like a little circle, and then there's proteins on the outside of that circle. And inside that circle is the virus, on the outside are the proteins. So viruses have H and N proteins, and they are the proteins on the outside. So there's 16 different H's and 9 different N's. I've also seen different numbers, like there's 11 different N's.
Oh, wow.
This one was from an article on CDC, and it could have been like a previous one. Maybe there's more, but from my, what I
wouldn't be surprised to see the number increase over the years just because of adapting and mutating. So
yeah. And finding new ones. I 100% agree. Influenza A H1N1 virus is what the 1918 one was, which I want to say that might have been the H1N1 might have been the same proteins in swine flu. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong, but I think that might have been swine
flu. 2006 or something.
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah. The HA gene of an influenza virus determines the property of the virus HA surface protein. I know that sounds like a circle, but yeah. Yeah. The HA surface proteins allow an influenza virus to enter and infect a healthy respiratory tract cell. Okay. So HA... Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that's really important because we see that a lot of types of these flus also have a respiratory component to it.
Yeah.
So that makes sense.
Yeah. And so HA also is also targeted by antibodies produced by the immune system to fight infections.
Okay. So it makes it so it's impossible to fight it too.
Yeah. Well, what it's saying is it goes into the healthy, HA focuses on getting into the respiratory tract cells, and your antibodies are what attacks the HA. And then NA protein allows influenza virus to escape an infected cell and infect other cells. So once it's in that cell, and then allows you to push it. So the antibodies against NA do not protect infection, but they do significantly limit the ability of the virus to spread. So HA is like the cop in front with the gun who's like, okay. Are we good? Okay, let's go in. And then the people, you know, the antibodies are the one who's trying to support. Shoot it. And yeah, and like the antibodies are the one who actually can kill HA. Yeah. And then NA are the ones who come in, and once they're in, they infiltrate the other rooms. Then those are the ones that people have a harder time killing. It was an awful metaphor. We get it though.
I mean, it makes sense to me.
Yeah, I found it really, really interesting. I want to say H is usually doing with like pigs, and N usually goes towards avian. It was kind of confusing because they say the origin, the animal origins of the 1918 before it happened was most likely avian, like bird. Yeah. But a lot of the makeup or components or whatnot of the HNs that they researched of the Spanish flu were mostly pig, like swine oriented, which if it's influenza can go either way anyway. So and NA share both with mammalian and avian viruses.
Got it.
So flu virus, we're talking about retrovirus, RNA. RNA is a single strand, kind of like DNA has two strands of genes.
RNA is just the one.
And I guess I've heard some viruses can have DNA. I don't know. I've only heard about the RNA.
Okay.
So retroviruses have a high mutation rate, which isn't all necessarily always bad, but it's just something that they have.
Okay.
And when it duplicates, it can change the H and N, which did not know that.
Wow.
Which can make bodies like the bodies of viruses hard to recognize. And this is called antigenic drift.
Wow.
So genic.
Antigenic shift.
Yeah, okay. Antigenic shift. An antigenic shift can have two different viruses that shift and switch proteins.
Wow.
So you can have, you have an H, and I'm just making up these numbers and not like these are specific actual diseases. So you have H1, N2, and then you have H3, N4. Mm-hmm. If those pretty much like, oh, hey, what's up? We're in the body. They can switch each other's. So then you could get an H1, N4.
Man.
Kind of thing. So
crazy.
That blew my mind.
Wah, wah.
So talking about the second, before we get into the second wave, my last little science-y fact here is this is probably why the second wave of the 1918 flu pandemic happened and how it happened and why there's so many deaths. And some who got the first had some immunity partial to the second wave, which is really interesting. And it was spread through respiratory droplets. So it's a different, because there's different types of airborne, and the airborne is very specific where they're so small that they're actually in the air.
Right.
When you're talking about air respiratory droplets, that's it's like in
coming out of your mouth.
They're heavier because they're actual droplets. And so that's a common way that most
coughing, sneezing, and then of course those things getting into your anywhere there's a mucous membrane. So back into your nose, your eyes, your face, your mouth.
Hence why you're not supposed to touch your face.
Don't touch your face.
Yeah, which I have the
which I'm just doing right now as I speak to you, but I'm in my own home, so.
Exactly. That's what one joke I've been making, because I'm literally just, I've been in my house.
Just like with your hands over your face, like, almost
Yeah, I can
do
this.
Like, it's the only time I can actually, like, pick my nose, rub my eyes, grab some out of my teeth.
I was telling Brett that a friend dropped off some fruit for us and food, and I actually, it's all mandarin oranges, so I actually washed them in the sink, and I was telling Kim, because they were from Costco, and I was like, there's
everybody
just so much stuff. Yeah, so I just threw them in the sink and washed the outside and laying them dry. And he's like, oh, that makes sense. I'm like, yeah, we should be doing it with all the food out of the grocery stores. Yeah, just in
you
case.
Should. You should. I mean, you know, even the chicken that I got the from Food Max. And of course, AJ's worried about that because he's like, Food Max, they closed because they had somebody who died from COVID. I'm like, yeah, but it was back on March 3rd. It was a while ago. They reopened. The store's been completely sanitized, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
And the chicken that I bought, I mean, it's not like organic, the highest quality, whatever. It's just probably like the slaughterhouse, whatever chicken. But I literally just like let it thaw out and then I washed it thoroughly and then put my spices and yada, yada, yada on.
So. Well, if you cook it, you should be fine.
Yeah, exactly. And then I cooked it at 350 degrees. So it's
so that was one thing because we were talking about our vegetables and we're like, oh shit, blah, blah, blah. But then if you cook it,
you're not eating them raw.
You should kill it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
If you're eating stuff raw, wash it like you've never washed it before. Just wash it like you wash your hands, which sounds weird. But
you know what? Vinegar. So you use a solution, 50-50 vinegar and water, and then you let it air dry and you're fine. So
yeah, that's a great,
That'll break that bubble because viruses have that little encasement around it and there's only certain things that will kill it. So alcohol, vinegar is one of them because of the high acidic content and then of course soap. So
that's
all right. So we're going into the second wave, ladies and gentlemen.
We're back to Brett. Tell us about it.
Back to me. All right. Let's see. And I don't know why this is giving me the burps. Excuse me. In late August 1918, military ships departed the English port of Plymouth, carrying troops unknowingly infected by this new and far deadlier strain of Spanish flu. So again, Bree mentioned that the strains can have a shift. So this particular flu took a shift. So it was definitely a lot more contagious and it's much more deadly. As the ships arrived in the cities like Brest, France, Boston in the United States and Freetown in West Africa, and then other international ports. So ports was like one of the biggest ways these things were not contained because it was back and forth people and ports were always very busy. The second wave of the global pandemic began. The rapid movement of soldiers around the globe was a major spreader of the disease. Of course, as we already know, and the entire military industrial complex moving lots of men in a material and materials in crowded conditions was a huge contributing factor to it. So again, this was a much deadlier form. I did find out that more US soldiers died from the flu than were killed in the battle, especially during the second wave. So
It said that more people died from the flu than civilians and service people of the war. Of all the war too, which
the entire,
is
the whole combined thing. So all battles involved.
Yeah. Cause a third of the people died from the flu.
Yeah. And a third of the world, the world's population.
Yeah.
Several Pacific Island territories were hit particularly hard during this second wave. The pandemic reached them from New Zealand, which was also too slow to implement measures to prevent ships such as the SS Talon carrying the flu, leaving from its ports from September through November 1918, which again, most of us find that's the usual time for flu. The death rate from the flu skyrocketed. In the United States alone, 195,000 Americans died from the flu in just the month of October. So we've been looking at our monthly totals and we're freaking out about like
you know, a few hundred here, a few hundred there. Imagine 195,000. Like, that is a huge impact.
Yeah.
And much more virulent as well. Now, there were, again, contributing factors to this. One was compliance. Were people listening to this? Part of it was the lateness of the U.S. saying this, you know, because they're right now focusing on propaganda for the war and what have you. So they're not focusing on, hey, don't go out, don't do this, yada, yada, yada. You know, they're focusing on wartime efforts. So for them, it's more important to get that information out. And I think that was a big issue for a lot of people at some point, as opposed to now where we're putting it in the forefront and we're focusing on it. Like, Trump's not doing this. So anyway, I digress.
We weren't supposed to go into that.
Sorry. I still haven't said the word. Unlike normal seasonal flu, which mostly claims victims among the very young and very old, the second wave of the Spanish flu exhibited what's called a W curve. So this is really interesting. High number of deaths among young and old, but also a huge spike in the middle that was composed of otherwise healthy 25 to 35 year olds in the prime of their life. And again, those are your soldiers. Okay. These are your soldiers. These are your soldiers coming home to their families associating with other friends, et cetera, et cetera. So it's passing around this, like, you know, millennial set, I guess, what would be in our current terms.
And I would say that part of that has to do with the virulence again, because of how deadly this virus was.
Because it was strain was.
Of those big things of being infections and virulence, that I don't know if I'm saying right, but we are what I'm saying.
Yes,
now.
You are.
they are both on the high point. So it was easy to catch and easy to take over your body, essentially.
Correct. Yeah. And that's what really freaked out the medical establishment, because they're used to the whole, like, you know, let's flatten the curve. And it's even back then, it was like, okay, we're going to get to a spike, we're going to plateau, and things are going to be fine again.
Yeah.
But this just went like, whoop, 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 whoop. And the second one was even more so. So that really kind of freaked them out. The highly fatal second wave was responsible for the most U.S. deaths attributed to the pandemic. So in general, that was the most ever. Now, one example of this noncompliance was Philadelphia. 4,597 people died the week ending October 16th. But by November 11th, it had disappeared almost completely from the city. Now, that being said, remember what I said about the most virulent strain going with the people who were passing. I think that played into it. But that many people got sick and died because they actually had a parade. So they had a parade to welcome home the soldiers, and some 2,000 some odd, I mean, it was a ridiculous amount of people came to this parade, and that's where you got this super outbreak, you know? So we're still having stuff like that that's occurring now. So,
yeah, I was going to say, to compare that too, if you don't mind real quick. They compare I think I did in one of our previous episodes too, and it's a common speaking term about why during this time people should have stayed home, I'll say, there's another example that during that time, St. Louis, they were supposed to have a parade and kind of do the same thing, but instead the mayor's like, hey, we're not going to do that. Everyone stay home. And they had a much lower number of illness and deaths because of making that decision of having not a whole bunch of people crowded together on the streets and instead stay home.
Correct.
It made a huge difference.
You know, and I don't know what it's going to take for people to see that, but hey, you know.
Yeah.
In due time, folks, in due time. All right. So then I'm going to jump into now a day-to-day life. Okay. So what it was like to live back then while this was going on. So this is...
Oh my God. I just want to say also, I have not read any of this, so I'm really excited to hear this part that Brett did. This might be my most... People are going to be asking us about this, so I'm really, really interested. Go ahead, Brett. I'm so excited.
It's okay. No, I'm actually kind of excited for this too. So I tried to find stuff on, like, what was it like to live back then during this whole epidemic or pandemic while it was going on. So So one of the things that I followed was like... A girl who was writing in her diary during this time. Mm-hmm. So that was one. Another, I got some papers that indicated, like, hey, this is what's happening daily from Memphis, Tennessee. And then there was one other one, which I'll get into. So because of the isolated nature of the quarantine, again, people aren't used to this, you know, The pandemic suffered largely, most people suffered largely in private. Unable to lean on their friends and neighbors for support, people experienced crisis alone in houses with shuttered windows. Okay, you guys, remember, this is not like today. We don't have the kind of communication that we do today, even in the 80s or the 60s. You know, like if this happened in the 60s, you know, we would, people had phones. They could reach out and call somebody, but they didn't have that kind of, I mean, it's not to say that phones weren't around, that's fine, but I'm saying like it, the technology wasn't there. Not in the same way. Not in the same way. One of the little girls had written, "I stayed in all day and didn't even go to Rita's. Mama doesn't want us to go around any more than we need to." So this
good one job, Mama.
Yeah. Yay, Mom. These individual feelings of loneliness compounded and in some cases eroding once strong community bonds. People were actually afraid to talk to one another. And again, I mentioned before that people weren't getting food delivered because they're like, you know, don't come near me. A gentleman named Daniel Tunkel, an influenza survivor from 1918. And I don't know if you guys have read this, but somebody, there's two gentlemen right now who survived 1918 and this, and actually had the virus and survived both.
Oh, wow. I knew some of them were like baby. There's some people who were babies during the time of influenza.
Right?
Yeah. Because I guess that's 102. They're old AF.
Yeah. So, during a 1997 interview for PBS, TV show American Experience, Daniel said, "It was almost like, don't breathe in my face. Don't look at me and breathe in my face because you may give me the germ that I don't want." And you never knew from day to day who was going to be next on the death list. So that's kind of a frightening way to live, even a child. Like,
oh, yeah.
As an adult, yes. But as a child, you're just like, wait, what?
Yeah.
In an interview in 1980, Glenn Holler described the way the flu frayed social ties in his North Carolina hometown. He said people would come up and look in your window and holler and see if you were still alive, but they wouldn't come in. They'd be like, "Are you okay? You alive? All right, good. You're dead?
See you later.
Hello? Hey, they're dead." You know what I mean? It's like,
bring out your dead.
Ugh. Right. And it's like, there were corpses in the street. I mean, imagine having to go to the grocery store, but even before you get there, you saw numerous bodies laying in the street. It was just like that. In many places, the loneliness and suspicion caused by the flu continued to pervade American society in very subtle ways. To some, it seemed that something had been permanently lost. People didn't seem as friendly as before. They didn't visit each other. They didn't bring food over. They didn't have parties like they used to. The neighborhood changed. People changed. Everything changed. I definitely feel like that's going to happen now. Definitely.
Yeah.
In cities where proactive public health commissions exhibited strong leadership, people still maintain faith in one another. So some people still believe that there was that personable, "I'm going to help you. We're here to through this together." In some cities like Philadelphia, bodies lay along the street and in morgues for days, similar to medieval Europe during Black Death. So like I said, for days. So you can imagine the smell that was going on during this time too is not particularly enjoyable.
I'm sure you had a mix of there's too many bodies to handle and people not wanting to touch the bodies because of what they died from.
I did read that one Pennsylvania school closed, but when they closed, they opened their windows and they displayed bodies of the dead so you could actually have like your, so let's say your grandmother died. They would bring her to the school and they would display her body in this window so that you could hold your ceremony, say your goodbyes, and then they would bury her. I was like, geez, that is crazy. So they put them on display.
Wow.
Because, so, you know, but I mean, I don't know which is the lesser evil, because I've heard these days that like people are like, so over in Italy or like, I think in Iran is that somebody came and picked somebody's dead body up from their home. They took him away and he's like, "I don't know what morgue they were from. I don't know where my father's ashes are. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like they know nothing," as opposed to here where they brought someplace displayed publicly. So it's kind of like a catch 22, but like, it's a love hate thing. Like I think some people are like, "Yay, I get to see my grandmother one last time. There she is. I want to say this to her. I want to say that." And other people who are like, "I don't want to fucking see this. I'd rather just not know where they are." You know? So everybody holds a different opinion, but it's just kind of crazy that they would do something like that back then.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah. So, let's see. In light of the potential economic turmoil and human suffering, an understanding of state and federal government response to the 1918 pandemic may also provide some light into what, if anything, the government did at any level to minimize the modern day pandemic at that time. So, and they did do some, they, like I said, they did have propaganda out for the war, but they also did things like wash your hands, distance yourself from people, sneeze into a handkerchief, cough into a handkerchief, things like that. So things were being done. So this is the Little Rock, Arkansas, article I found, how influenza affects business. The Arkansas Gazette, this is the October 19th issue from 1918, page 4. Merchants in Little Rock say their business declined 40%. Others estimate 70%. The retail grocery business has reduced by 1/3, which again, not like today. Businesses back then were very different than they are from today. I don't think those people were considered essential. When they were sick, they were sick. They closed down.
Well, a lot of them were probably small, like family
grocery,
ran.
They weren't like grocery stores of today where they were ginormous. No. They were small little corner shops or like stands.
Yeah.
One department store, which had a business of 15,000 daily, 200,000, 265 and 2006 dollars. So this is an article I got from 2016 or 2006, is not doing more than half than that. So they lost half of their business. Bed rest is emphasized in the treatment of influenza. As a result, there has been an increase in demand for beds, mattresses, and springs.
Mm-hmm.
Little Rock businesses are losing $10,000 a day on average. So in 2006 dollars, when this article was written, it was $133,000. Today's dollars, probably close to 200, anywhere between 200 and 300, maybe. Maybe even upwards of 500. Who knows?
I was like 15 years ago.
Quite a lot. So.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
This is an actual loss, not a decrease in business that may be covered by an increase in sales when the quarantine was over. It's just straight up lost. They were done. Mm-hmm. It couldn't be sold later.
This was before like business insurance, I'm sure.
Correct. The only businesses in Little Rock, in which there has been an increase in activity is the drugstore, of course. Another article from Memphis, Tennessee, influenza crippling Memphis industries, the commercial appeal, October 5th, 1918, page 7. Physicians report they are kept too busy by combating the disease to report the number of their patients and have little time to devote to other matters. So literally they were completely 100% focused on people and that's it. So at the time, numbers were not going to be accurate. To this day, they still aren't accurate. People say it's between 50 million to 100 million people that passed. We have no idea how many people actually had the virus. Industrial plants are running under a great handicap. Many of them were already short of help because of the draft. So they're even more so now because now people are calling out sick. Out of a total of about 400 men used in the transportation department of the Memphis Street Railway, 124 were incapacitated yesterday. This curtailed. So train stopped running.
Yeah.
Cumberland Telephone Company reported more than 100 operators absent from their post. Telephone company asked that unnecessary calls be eliminated. Tennessee Mines may shut down. Commercial appeal, October 18th, 1918, on page 12, indicated 50% decrease in production reported by coal mine. Mines throughout the Tennessee and Southern Kentucky valleys are on the verge of closing down, owing to the epidemic that the that's raging through the mining camp. So miners were getting sick and not being able to go to work. Coalfield, Tennessee, population of 500, has only 2% of well people. 2% of their population.
Holy shit.
Okay.
Oh my gosh.
98% of people in that town were sick. Despite the severity of the 1918 influenza, however, there has been relatively little research done on the economic of the pandemic. So what I do know is that males aged 18 to 40 were hardest hit by influenza. That had serious economic consequences for the families because they lost their primary breadwinner. And later on in the report that I had read, that there was a significant loss of prime age working employees. So the economy itself had problem delegating people in their businesses and like making businesses function because there wasn't enough people of the right age to make them work. Finally, unlike polio and smallpox, which were considered, I believe, epidemics, not pandemics. I'm not really sure. Maybe they were pandemics. No famous people of the era died from influenza. Thus, there was no public perception that even the politically powerful and rich were not immune from the virus. So Woodrow Wilson got it. Roosevelt got it, but they recovered. And there was only like a handful of kind of lesser known people that actually died from it. So it, I feel like it didn't get the popularity that it would have gotten if they said like major film star dies of, you know what I mean?
Yeah. 100%.
That would have been an issue. So,
All right. Then I'm going to go into things that worked before we go back to Brie. So the things that worked today. So a San Francisco health officer shot three people because they refused to wear a face mask. We're not going to do that.
Please don't do that. No.
In Arizona, people handed out $10 fines for those caught without wearing protective gear. So these are the people who are not being compliant. They're saying, look, there's going to be an issue for not being compliant. So eventually the most drastic and sweeping measures did pay off, implementing a multitude of strict closures and controls on public gatherings. St. Louis, San Francisco, Milwaukee, Kansas City, they all responded the fastest and the most effectively. So they actually lessened their curve. Interventions were credited with cutting transmission of rates by 30 to 50%.
Damn.
New York City happened to react the earliest. Unlike today, and they said mandatory quarantines, they staggered business hours and experienced the lowest death rate on the Eastern Seaboard. Analysis of when cities closed the 1918 schools, saloons and theaters, banned public events and urged social distancing, demonstrated before the virus spreads to the community, it did flatten the curve. So the places where it was recorded, it did show that it was like, oh, there are less deaths here. One study took a portion of the population between September 2018 to February 19, which is the most deadliest time, and looked at 43 cities that instituted things like school closures and bans on social gatherings, as well as other social distancing practices. Those that followed strictly, and according to the study, showed quicker economic recovery and higher employment. So the economy also fared well from people who also instituted and followed the guidelines that were out there. Okay. Huge. So yeah. I thought this was really interesting, and I didn't know this. The idea of contagion prompting quarantines and isolation dates back to the Justinian plague.
Years.
So long ago.
However, I did not know that.
Epidemiological work by Snow and others in the 19th century. And I did find out this person's name is John Snow, and they're like, not the one from the show. And others during the 19th century. Further, these notions of contagion and understanding of transmission, public health departments grew out of these advances and the belief in the ability that man could control nature. Sanitation, vaccination, and other public hygiene efforts in the late 19th century enabled public health officials to gain power and authority. However, the influenza public epidemic did challenge that. You know what I mean? It was just like, no, this pandemic is going to be way worse than what you all have imagined. So go ahead and try and do your thing. But the massive morbidities from the common illnesses of influenza were mysterious and frightening. Many of the measures formerly known to work were ineffective. They were not prepared for the event of this magnitude, lacking the organization and infrastructure constrained by the war. So the war, again, influenced the pandemic influenced the war. The Great War provided the rhetoric of nationalism necessary to usher in these authoritative responses and losses of liberty. So while people were taking away the liberties of people saying you can't go outside, we're also still all in it for the war. You know what I mean? So it's like that feeling of togetherness was like, okay.
One for all
exactly.
kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. Very so united. That kind of heightened it.
I think they understood that their liberties aren't being taken away for no reason. It's literally correct. A way to save people. And I feel like that's a mindset that a lot of people don't understand, that they feel like their rights are being taken away and they feel like it's going to last forever.
And at first it was like people were like pissed off and upset about it. I get it. But like then they were like, okay, wait. This is good. This is all good.
Yeah.
One of the things that happened in hospitals that made this all work better was that all bedding and rooms were periodically disinfected to kill whatever pathogen pervaded them. In a naval ambulance trains, so anytime there was ambulatory trains where they were bringing people back and forth to hospitals, they did this. They cleaned with something called Izol antiseptic solution.
Okay.
That produced sputum, so all the shit that came out of people's mouths. That was, of course, filled with these nasty viruses, was to be destroyed. So the hospital said, okay, we're going to give people sputum cups that we're going to dispose of or disinfect them. So twice daily, if they would go buy somebody's cups, they would take them, they would dump them out, they would disinfect them and give them back to the person. So the nasal discharges, they were collected in napkins and thrown away, burned, incinerated.
Well, because I'm sure at this time too, this is when people actually use hankies.
Correct.
And so they switched out the hanky for disposable. Yep. So smart.
So paper napkins. An antiseptic hand solution was played conveniently
placed conveniently for those on duty in the influenza ward. So this is a first. Again, this is a, you know, an antiseptic hand solution. So this is, I feel like, this is a precursor to the hand sanitizer that we have today.
100%. Yeah.
One friend report also suggested that the staff of influenza ward should wear blouses inside the ward and remove them when leaving. Again, something that we're practicing to this day. Okay.
Yeah. So
those things worked. They're going to continue to the day. Mask wearing led to a rapid decline in number of cases of influenza as well. So again, I'm sure you're all very familiar with a recent introduction of we all have to wear masks, or they recommend that we do it because it decreases. They are finding that they're looking at the numbers and what are happening when we institute these procedures. And they actually started studying them and realizing this makes a difference. Let's write this down. So huge.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, so Bree's going to go into something super duper cool.
I'm so excited. So before I delve into the really, really, whoa, that's crazy they did that, I want to go over, first of all, do a little history and then why. So as a side note that I guess I forgot to talk about this flu is also when it was discovered, they thought it was a bacteria and not a virus. They didn't understand the differences quite yet. They thought the flu was actually caused by bacteria. That's when they finding out like things weren't working that would work for bacteria. However, a lot of the stuff to prevent to get bacteria tend to mirror the things to prevent getting flu, which is like washing your hands, like getting a bacterial infection or sickness.
Yeah, general hygiene.
Exactly. Me and Brett were like, oh yeah, we should probably tell people why it was called the Spanish flu. There's a reason why we're not using that term as much. Like, we're trying to avoid it. Just kind of like, I've heard people call the measles the like, or call something else the German measles. Please don't use terms like that. There's terms being called today.
There's so many bad terms.
Please avoid certain, they sound like xenophobic, even if it quote unquote originated somewhere. That doesn't matter to put that kind of visual on a sickness. It's not cool, y'all. Just call it what the scientists and professionals are calling it.
Yeah.
Professionals and scientists. Professionals.
Pro.
Yeah.
Okay. Keyword pro.
Not people who think they're professional. Okay. I have an article that's actually updated recently, and this I'm going to try to read through it somewhat quickly. But the history.com of why it was called the Spanish flu, and it's from Evan Andrews. So as the pandemic reached epic proportions in the fall of 1918, it was commonly known as the Spanish flu or Spanish lady in the United States and Europe. Many assume this was because of the sickness had originated on the Iberian Peninsula, which is like southern Spain area. That's apparently where my family is originally from, like years and years, like eons ago.
Oh my God.
Yeah, like way long, like before.
My grandpa
immigrated here from Mexico to California. And so I'm thinking, obviously, it's way before that. But the nickname was actually the result of a widespread misunderstanding. Spain was one of only a few major European countries to remain neutral during World War One, and unlike in the Allied and Central Powers nations, where wartime censors suppressed news of the flu to avoid affected morale, the Spanish media was free to report on it in gory detail. So news of the sickness first made headlines in Madrid in late May 1918, and the coverage only increased after Spanish King Alfonso the VIII, I believe, came down. Oh, no, wait, that's 13. Sorry, the 13th. Roman numbers. Oh, God.
Every time.
I was like, that's an X, not a V. So 13th. So he came down with a nasty case a week later. And since the nation's undergoing a media blackout could only see and read in-depth accounts from Spain news sources, they naturally assume that the country was the pandemic's ground zero.
Yep.
So the Spanish, meanwhile, believed that the virus had spread to them from France. So they took to calling it the French flu. And while it's unlikely that the Spanish flu originated in Spain, scientists are still unsure of its source. So France, China, and Britain have all been suggested as potential birthplaces of the virus.
Yeah.
And as has the United States, where the first known case was reported, which is the one that Brett mentioned, at the military base in Kansas in March 11, 1918.
Yes.
This, again, goes backwards, too, because I totally agree with Brett that I think this was going on before that.
Yeah.
I think the military base was the first time it just took... like notice. Yeah. Like hold in like notice.
And I mean, we heavily relied on like shipping port to port way back when. I mean, we still do, but there's definitely much more stringent rules and regulations than there were back then. So you had live animals, in with people, you had people in with people, and so on and so on. So you had no idea how quickly things could pass and get passed. And not only that, cleanliness wasn't a thing. You know, defecation and urine probably was everywhere, people throwing up, whatever, you know what I mean? It was one of those things where it was like, oh God, this guy just threw up all over me. But you know what I mean? Like, it's not like today where you're on a cruise ship and you're in your own room and you're throwing up in your own, you know what I mean? Like, it's not the same. It's not the same.
And obviously we learned in cruise ships, even with the cleanliness, you can still get affected with certain types of illness. And like, it's funny because when we talk about avian and swine flus and it's like, oh, like these animals are the origin, literally when these animals have these sickness, they really can spread it to people. And it's usually a special strain when it mutates to a certain way, but it is how that happens, which is, again, mind-blowing to me. Very interesting.
Yeah.
So this is the part that I think Brett might be excited for my part.
Yay! I love this. I think I told you about this, right? I was like, you've got to read this!
Well, and I was planning to anyways, but because I was going to, we got this from the CDC. They have a whole page that's like cdc.gov/flu/pandemic-resources/reconstruction-1918/virus.html. This article specifically was by Douglas Jordan, and it was with contributions from Terrence Tumpy and Barbara Jester. So I kind of bullet pointed it and condensed it so it's more understandable because there was a lot of scientific stuff.
A lot of scientific jargon. Really got to get into it. So, but I will highly recommend it. I mean, if you guys are really into reading about pandemics or epidemics, I would highly recommend it. It's such a great resource and there's so much cool stuff. It's really cool to read about.
If you just even look up like the 1918 pandemic, and then going on the CDC site, there's ones from like the 1960s, 1970s. And, like, there's been multiple pandemics in the world, and it even goes over the like recent ones. I think were like 2009, 2006, and other ones because we've had like MERS, SARS.
Yeah, MERS, SARS. There was the Ebola.
Yeah, Ebola.
Yeah, there was a handful. So, yeah, but none of them have been nearly as deadly. I mean, I feel like we're in medieval times. Cut off we are.
Oh my gosh. So 1918 was the most deadly pandemic to our knowledge.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is, again, why we're kind of talking about this because it's so interesting.
Why we're talking about it. Hello.
Yeah. So, because it is a disaster.
Such a disaster.
This is also when we get to find out about how deadly it was, too. So, virus hunters and researchers searched for the 1918 virus, sequenced the genome, the complete list of genetic instructions that make an organism similar to the blueprint used for construction, recreate the virus, and study its secret to better prepare for future pandemics.
Very cool.
So that was like the, this is what we're going to talk about, the TLDR, or however, TDLR, whatever it is. So to give you a little background, in November 15th through the 20th in 1918, 72 of the 80 citizens in a small village, Alaskan town or village, I guess, in Alaska, passed away from the virus in 5 days.
Yeah.
When you have 72 people pass away in a small town, you don't, and there's only 8 of you left over.
Just to be clear, it's 72 of 80 citizens. These were adults. So there's still a number of children left.
Oh, is it? Because my thing just said 70. Okay.
Yeah.
So as adults. Oh no, there's children because they bury children. They dig up children.
Oh. Oh. Okay. Yeah. I thought it was just adults. Okay. So I'm.
There's
because
it's
wrong.
A really, really small town. But maybe it was more so. Maybe they're talking about the 72 of the 80 were adults, but maybe there was children also that they didn't count in there.
Okay.
There could have been more people buried in general.
Gotcha.
Maybe 72 of them were adults. They were buried in a mass grave. The grave was frozen in permafrost and untouched since 1951. Mm. And the permafrost meant that bodies were better preserved because it's so cold in Alaska. I want to say Jonah, but it looks like it's Johan.
It's Johan.
Johan. Thank you. There it is. So Johan Halton's first attempt with permission, he visited the mass grave and collected the lung tissue samples from 5 different people. And I remember one of those was a little girl. He described it that she was in a little dress and had her hair like in pigtails and bows.
Yes, you are correct. Yes. I do remember that. Okay.
So, but that doesn't mean that there wasn't maybe the 72 were adults and then maybe
Think it was 72 adults, but they weren't talking about the children, because I was saying like 72 out of the 80 adults that were there were died.
So. Okay. So he got five different people that were buried and took their lung samples, tissue samples from their lungs. He took a plane back to his lab that required multiple stops along the way for gas. And at each stop, he would refreeze the tissue with a fire extinguisher using its carbon dioxide.
So brilliant.
So and he was saying that
cold,
like,
which is important because you don't want to you need to have the virus be in that specific state in order to get the way you want it to get back. Yes.
So, and also this wasn't like his own personal jet. It was like ones with people. So people would be like, what the fuck is he doing? What the hell's going on there?
Why is the guy using a fire suit? Something on fire.
Yeah, exactly. So unfortunately, after he got back to the lab, he takes the tissue samples in and he tries to inject them into eggs in his lab. And this was supposed to regrow the virus and nothing happened. So
shitballs.
Didn't process. It was just like,
okay,
dud. So he just kind of like let it be. In 1997, many years later.
Yep.
Holton, I guess 80 years later. I don't know, 70. I'm not gonna do math. So, oh no, this was in the 50s. Sorry, take it back. But anyway, in 1997, Holton read an article by Dr. Tombenberger and his team, who extracted lung tissue from a serviceman who was ill and passed away from the 1918 flu in South Carolina. It was someone that was on a military base. And so they still had the sample from that guy. Mm. They were able to sequence part of the viral RNA. It was enough information to know that it was influenza A, H1N1, and novel flu. So I want to note the word novel, because novel, I think, confuses people and thinks it means like not a big deal, or like, oh, is this a novel, this and that.
Yeah.
Novel means new or unusual in an interesting way. Yeah. It has nothing to do with the severity of something. It all has to do with going, what the hell is this?
It's the uniqueness of it.
Yeah. It's something that's new to them. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not that they've seen before.
Yeah.
So it also indicated that belonged to a subgroup that came from humans and pigs versus avian. And Holton was 72 and ready to go back to that small Alaskan village to get more lung tissue. So he called up Dr. Tombenberger and to see if he wanted to join forces. So on his own dime, with whatever tools he could get, Holton traveled up to Alaska and found a well-preserved lung from a woman that he named Lucy. And he sent this tissue back to Dr. Tombenberger. And the article is also saying, which I find kind of funny, was that he brought his wife's gardening shears. Like, that's like the supplies he had.
He is his wife's garden hoe.
Like, he was just like, I need to get in there. This is like, I mean, he did on his own dime. So that's amazing.
That's hilarious. Good for him.
Right? I love it. So 1918 Spanish influenza virus. So those HA, I think it's the hemagglutinin gene.
Gluten.
There's a lot of N's in there. I don't know what's going on.
But,
so that was what I was talking about earlier with the difference between HA and NA. So with the tissue of the serviceman of South Carolina and with Lucy, they're able to sequence the full length HA gene sequence of the 1918 virus. Which meant the existing strand to which 1918 virus sequence were closely related to. So the closest strand of flu that we knew, and this is when those letters come in. A for influenza A, SW, no fucking clue, Iowa /30. So it was probably like 1930.
Yeah.
So this is the oldest classical swine influenza strain. No.
That they had on record.
Yeah, that they had on record.
That was, key, is that they had on record.
Exactly. So, actually, this makes sense. So A, influenza A, SW would be swine.
Yep.
Iowa, so originally in Iowa, and 30, most likely 1930 is my guess.
Okay.
So that's how they say this is that strain of flu.
That makes sense.
So this one, if we find the origin, this I will bring up once. So the one that we're going through now, say we find out that originated in California for whatever. Okay. So it would be A, and then I think this one is avian, maybe.
No, it was bat, wasn't it?
It's usually between avian, maybe either AV or maybe mammals, maybe BMA.
MA.
And then it'd be like California /19.
Okay, got it.
Or 20. But yeah, or
okay,
anyways,
that makes sense.
We get the gist. Yeah.
Yep.
So that's a really smart way to give you an idea of exactly where it comes from.
Got it.
So Dr. Paliz and Dr. Alfredo Garcia Sastry got together and they actually did more work with it. I think this is when I have a blank and I don't know why. So yeah. Between them and in 2005 with Dr. Tumpy, they reconstructed the virus.
Yeah.
So now because of all the work they put in, they did it in a lot of the reading was like how secure it was and how it was not used for a weapon. They literally were in a super secure lab to reconstruct the virus. So they actually have a copy of the virus.
Yeah.
So in a lot of the flu shots that we take, there is a
that's in there
piece of the so the 1918 flu is so we in don't that get flu it. Shot exactly
and that's what they're trying to do these days is that when there's a virus that erupts like it the way it's doing, they have to do research. I mean, they're literally scrambling as fast as they can, but people have to understand this is new, and when it's novel and new and different and interesting, that means it's presenting itself with things that people aren't normally
immune to.
And so we have to create something new for this. And that doesn't take like a day, you know, even with the technology we have. And then they have to test it. And then they have to bring it through, you know, trials, and they have to documentation. I mean, you know, everybody who talks about like the whole anti-vaxxer thing, this kind of comes to this too, is that you're not going to want a vaccine tried on you and go, okay, now I'm not going to get this deadly flu. Great. But 30 years from now, you can't have kids. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you don't want to give it to your child who's 5 years old and then find out 30 years from now, you can't have kids because they all took this. And, you know, it's just, it's one of those things that has to be studied. It really does. And I love
and a
that
lot of time,
people are doing that.
You know? Yeah. What Fauci was saying currently is I think there's one that they're testing already, but you have to wait at least a year to test it.
Correct.
We've all had a little bit of 1918 in us of the flu.
Aww.
It does make me wonder when we talk about flu and how much the flu takes every year.
Yeah.
When you get tested for the flu, if you get really sick, go to the hospital, you actually get tested for flu A and flu B.
Correct.
So I'm very, and that's like the strains that they
and
think.
And Tamiflu is made for those flus. So Tamiflu is the sort of like the anti-flu virus, like the medication that they will give you that will lessen or dampen the symptoms.
Yeah.
So you can kind of get through normal life or whatever. It's like, I've had it once. I've had it just once where I had gone in and I had started to feel like achy. I had a really high fever and I was like, I don't know what's going on. I don't have a strep, but you know, I was like, I have a little bit of a sore throat, but it's not like the usual. And she's like, you have the flu. I'm going to prescribe Tamiflu. You're going to take this for the next 5 days, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, okay, cool. And so that was supposed to be able to sort of cut it, but you have to catch the flu within the first, I think, 24 or 48 hours in order to be prescribed that. So again, we didn't have this kind of thing back in 1918.
Oh, no.
There was,
I go into that about the end part because of that.
Yeah. So there's evidence of some crazy things going on, but yes.
With the influenza A and influenza B, there's multiple strains, which is why there's multiple strains that the guess of what's going to happen every winter. Yeah. But I am curious when they talk about flu deaths, the general flu, are they talking about influenza A, influenza B, or both? And that's just a general thing to think about that. If anyone knows, I'd like to know. Okay. Continue on. Cause that means it's multiple strains. That also, when you're talking about the flu, there's actually multiple strains, again, of the flu, and they're all different. All right, Brett, take it away.
Okay, take it away. What did we learn? All right, so several organizations were developed during that time. A lot of things came into fruition. So the World Health Organization Global Influenza Surveillance and Response Team System, the GISRS, G-I-S-R-S, is a global flu surveillance network that monitors changes in seasonal flu viruses and also monitors the emergence of novel, i.e. in humans, et cetera, flu viruses, many of which originate from animal populations. So as we know, and as you have mentioned, that because of that, we need to be more vigilant in watching these things, okay? Expanded laboratory testing and flu surveillance capacity around the world has been an important focus on pandemic preparedness efforts. In 2004, CDC began an international surveillance capacity building initiative that entailed a 5-year period of financial support to improve laboratory diagnostic tests and surveillance of influenza-like illnesses called ILIs. So cool. and severe acute respiratory infections, again, SARIs or SARS, in 39 partner countries. So the development of these things is occurring because of these pandemics. Okay.
Yeah.
As part of the WHO's International Health Regulations, IHR, everything has like a little, what do they call it? Anagram?
Is
it
anagram? Yeah.
Yeah. All of them do. The countries
acronym
must
or anagram? I can never remember.
Acronym. That's what it is. Countries must notify WHO within 24 hours of any case of human infection caused by a novel influenza A virus subtype. This requirement is designed to help quickly identify emerging viruses with pandemic potential. So I believe in January is when the WHO was notified of this first virus that we're currently going through right now, the pandemic that we're currently going through. So, of course, back then that wasn't a thing, but this was developed since then. So that's what's come about. You know, this is what we've learned and how we're improving. In a severe pandemic, such as what occurred in 1918, if it happened today, it would likely still overwhelm the whole healthcare infrastructure, which we are seeing currently.
We're not laughing at you.
We're laughing with you because we're like, are you fucking serious? Yes, of course it would, because we're seeing it right now.
We're not supposed to talk about it, but we're going to let people make their own.
Make your own observations and observances on this, connections. Both in the United States and across the world, hospitals and doctors' offices would struggle to meet demand from the number of patients requiring care. True. Such an event will require significant increases in the manufacture, distribution, and supply of medications, products, and life-saving medical equipment, which is why you enact things like the Defense of War Act production and all that stuff. Mechanical ventilators, et cetera, et cetera. Businesses and schools would struggle to function, and even basic services like trash pickup and waste removal would be impacted. Now, luckily, that has not occurred. Essential workers like grocery stores, pharmacies, some or most restaurants, because not only are they trying to survive, but they're also providing food for people. And trash pickup is still there. I am ever grateful to these people and so glad that we, and I hope that on the back end of this, that we come up with an idea of let's pay them more. So just saying.
Yes. And I was going to say too, with restaurants, because people question why restaurants are open. A lot of times it's for elderly people who can't make their own food, and different other people who do not have the ability to make their own food. That's a thing. So that's why. Yeah. It helps those people who have that type of disadvantage. Okay, correct. Go on.
So sidebar, I learned from one of my friends who's a nurse in Oregon, God bless her and love her to death, told me that Chick-fil-A in Oregon was offering free chicken sandwiches to healthcare workers for the whole week.
Yes.
Which I love. And then the restaurant that I work at, which I'm currently unemployed because, again, we're not functioning right now, but they are still open for to-go and takeout orders. Not only did they provide a family meal for staff members today, they told them that they're doing contactless delivery. So they had family meal for all of our staff who was in need, and they gave them copious amounts too, which was incredible. But also did discounted dinners and box lunches for healthcare providers and people who are on the emergency front line. So love that.
Oh, I love it.
One of the things we also learned was the uncontrolled movement can lead to tragic outcomes. So the unusual circumstances of the First World War reverse the normal pattern of human movement in the pandemic. So that really was a huge factor in that. Instead of the sickest people staying put in bed, they were sent from home to the front line, and that contributed to a huge rapid spread of the disease. And many countries struggled to balance the national war interest with public health. So it was a big, big issue. Two of the major issues contributed to the gravity of the pandemic, the war effort, and the limited scientific knowledge. So back in 1918, we still didn't have vaccines. We didn't have general flu vaccines. We didn't have any real, you know, like today, like our scientific pickup from when a pandemic starts to occur, where they go, let's try this. And then they get an instant, like not an instant, but they're like, they've already come up with like, try this, add this, you know what I mean? And they're already doing better. They didn't have ventilators like they did back then, you know, that kind of thing. So it's like we have a limited amount of scientific and medical knowledge. And not only that, the war effort really hindered this in a major way. So
it the war effort hindered the needs in the United States and also spread it further out.
Correct.
And then also brought it back, if that makes sense. Like it moved it a lot more.
Yeah. It was definitely a lot more movement oriented because of that. So what did we learn? Non-pharmaceutical interventions like closings, isolation, and quarantines. Yes, yes, and yes. Let's do them. Let's enact them. Let's do them sooner, the better. Well, the sooner you know about it, the sooner you enact them, the less, the more you're going to lessen the curve. Economic support is a huge proponent. So when you have the government support of the people, you're going to recover that much faster. And again, if you're following these non-pharmaceutical interventions, you're going to recover faster. Yeah. Stockpiles, very important. Everybody needs to have a stockpile. Everybody should always have an emergency kit. I have stuff for a bug out bag. I did not account for masks, which I need to next time. So that will be added. Masks and gloves will be added to my stockpiles for future reference, but all of us should have them. Virus and bacteria identification and development of vaccines and medicine. That has come a long, long, long way.
Incredible
and
long way.
The improvement has been miles beyond what it used to be. Number five, we learned cleanliness is close to godliness, people. Be clean. Wash your hands. Wash your hands.
Wash your hands, you filthy animals.
Yeah. To take from Aaron and Aaron, wash your hands, you filthy animals. Please do. In all circumstances, I remember it being a thing when we were kids. Wash your hands before dinner. It should always be the case. Wash your hands before you eat at any time, whether you're in your own home or outside. It's very important. Don't touch your face.
Clean your doorknobs.
Clean your
take off your shoes before you go inside.
Take off your shoes. And I mean, in this particular day and age, if you're in an environment where you're surrounded by people who are sick, please take off your clothes, wash them, take a shower before you hug your loved ones. Compliance. Very important that you comply with regulations. If people aren't going to do it, guess who's going to suffer? Everybody. Comply. Do it because they tell you to do it. And the last thing that we learned from one of these pandemics back in 1918 was infection tracking. Again, what I just mentioned, that how the WHO developed these particular systems where they can actually track where these things are coming from, when they start, and how we can get ahead of the pandemic before it becomes just that, a pandemic. Yeah. So, and with that, I'm going to turn it back to Bree.
So some of the things I say do mirror what Brett just said. But with the advances in science, we understand sickness. We understand sickness overall between flu and bacteria and different types of sicknesses. For example, as I stated before, we thought it was bacterial infection, but now we know it's a virus. Medical technology and countermeasures at the time were limited or non-existent. So no diagnostic tests existed at the time, and they couldn't test for the influenza infection. In fact, doctors didn't know influenza viruses existed. Many hospital experts at the time thought that 1918 pandemic was called a bacterium called Pfeiffer's baculus. Bacillus. Thank you. which is known now as the Haemophilus or Haemophilus influenza. So yeah, we got that. Okay, close enough. So influenza vaccines did not exist at the time. Nope. And even antibiotics have not been developed yet.
Nope.
So that means like not even penicillin was a thing. That wasn't discovered till 1928. So 10 years after this.
Isn't that crazy?
It is.
I still can't believe that it was that long. I was like, wasn't penicillin like 1800s? Nope.
No. Yeah, it was a huge finding too. It was a huge
big win for the medical community for sure.
100%.
Yeah.
Likewise, there was no flu antivirals like Tamiflu that Brett was talking about. Those were not available. Again, they didn't really know much about viruses or that viruses were a thing.
Yeah.
Critical care measures such as intensive care support and medical ventilations were absolutely not available in 1918.
Not at all.
Without these medical countermeasures and treatment capabilities, doctors were left with few treatment options other than supportive care, which at that time meant like, here's a cold rag on your head. Let me hold your hand. Let me give you some whiskey, probably. So you're
dead. Alcohol was a huge thing back then. I remember that.
Oh yeah. Whiskey and Coke, man. Yep. Coca-Cola. That's a real thing, y'all. That they're not joking when they said there was actually Coke in Coca-Cola. Like cocaine was in Coca-Cola.
Yep.
We also have a general idea of where its animal's origin came from that we didn't know before. And we actually have the idea of the different types of influenzas, and we understand how a virus can spread and a better idea of how to prevent the spread. The understanding the ability of a virus to infect others and how it's virulent has been invaluable information for us to help fight against viruses like the one that took over the globe in 1918.
Yep. Dun, 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 dun. There you guys go.
We did it.
The pandemic.
of 1918.
Woo!
It's a big one. It's a doozy.
Brett, you did amazing with your research. I loved all the information you brought out. It was so good.
So let's cite our sources because we're like that.
Yeah.
Because we pretty much just rip things off of the internet.
Yeah, especially me when I had to read that history.com. But I resourced that. I told them. Yeah, that was me reading it. But I sourced that. As we mentioned before, and I'm pretty sure I'm going to tag them in the tweet when we release this podcast.
Yay!
Will Kill You, episode one. Every one of their episodes amazing. Episode one.
Listen to the errands.
Oh, so good.
They're amazing.
CDC, pretty much anything of the 1918 pandemic, we went off all that stuff. I even gave that specifically.
For sure.
Some of the information I got was from ncbi.nlm.nih.gov. One of the articles of PMC 18739. Brett sent me that great information that was from virusstanford.edu.
I use them as well.
That was great. That was the flu science medicine page. You have
fantastic.
Any other sources?
I have a few. Yeah. I, of course, also used a couple of those sources as well, like the cdc.gov and history.com. Mm-hmm. I also sourced nationalgeographic.com, theatlantic.com, stlouisfed.org, vox.com, and listverse.com. I did... also, 4 days ago, BuzzFeed came out with one on the 1918 pandemic. I thought it was pretty funny, but check them out too, because they actually did one 4 days ago. So
that's excellent. I'm going to look that up.
Yeah. So that, I mean, it's like, of course, they have a couple of little funny things because they're BuzzFeed and they always do, but also very serious. And they did actually touch on a lot of the things that we did. So if you want to find a very short and condensed version of what we did, BuzzFeed has a good one as well. Yeah. So I had a lot of fun doing this.
Me too.
It was fascinating to read about it because we are in a current pandemic, and it was just so interesting to see how the world dealt with it back then versus how we're dealing with it now.
Yeah.
So just super, super interesting stuff. And I'm glad that we did this. I think what I've learned for this is, like, for sure to update my bug out bag to include things like masks, medicines that may take a while to deteriorate, replenishing them every once in a while. Mm-hmm. And of course, things like toilet paper.
Oh my God. My friend.
Always have lots on hand.
My friend dropped off some food. I don't know if this was in any of the recording per se, but my friend dropped off some oranges today, like some food for us. And she dropped off a couple rolls of toilet paper because we were close to the end of ours. And I was like, oh, thank God. But Caleb also bought a emergency pack of RV, like 1.5 ply probably toilet paper for emergencies.
Hey, but girl.
Oh my God, I'll take it.
Do what you got to do.
Right?
Do what you
got to
do.
Yeah, I think, you know? I got, other than, like, I love to hear, now I know what the H means and the N means, a lot better than I ever have before, and the differences of the flu, and I finally understand the backslash things. And I also learned that I'm going to carry more hand sanitizer with me. I used to have a thing on the side of my purse, but, and I used it, but not as much. I'm definitely going to use it more because I'm
definitely a
public transit person, and I guess I'll try to touch my face less, but I'll try.
I'll try. Yeah. I'll do what I can. I think for me, again, I'm also a public transit person, but nowadays I'm more so just like walking or biking, but I'm definitely going to be using and more cognizant of like how often I wash my hands. Mm-hmm. We're always very adamant about that at where I work. Cleanliness is one of our sort of our tenants, or whatever you call them, our goals or our vision statement. It's part of who we are, is cleanliness. So it's like, we would definitely wash our hands more often than I think most restaurant workers would.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate, because that's, again, where a viral spread can happen in a really bad way.
Really fast.
But I think a lot of us can learn from this. I hope that we come out on the other side of it more, knowledgeable about just general hygiene.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of us will.
Yeah, I agree.
The one thing that I think that's going to make me a little sad is I feel like a lot of people are definitely going to be a little bit more socially distanced in general, more reluctant to hug, more reluctant to shake hands, at least for the next six months to a year, maybe even further. You know, we might become a society in America where, you know, or even Italy. I mean, you've seen Italy. Italy is a country where you greet and you embrace and you kiss. That is, and you can see how
that's part of the culture and community. I'm not saying
that that's the entire contributor, but boy, I tell you, it's definitely going to be contributor.
Yeah.
So we may have to become a community like China or like Japan, where we bow and we don't embrace, because
that is something that we generally have to worry about. Yeah. So,
well, I would, I mean,
it's a scary thing, but yeah, you know, it is what it is. And hopefully people are great, more grateful on the other side of this.
I really hope that people take a more important note to not go out when they're sick, when they're possible. I hope we have the, mostly it's financial support for workers to be able to do this, but to be able to not go to work when they're sick. Right now, it's a different thing that we're talking about being asymptomatic. So we're not talking about that. But in general, there's a lot of people who are autoimmune out there. And so when I'm just sick in general, I try not to go out. And I hope that makes people more conscious of what they're doing when they don't feel well.
Well, yeah, because it's like if you're one of these workers where you rely your shift to shift or paycheck to paycheck, you're like, okay, well, if I'm not going to get paid for there because I'm a worker, an hourly worker, and I don't get sick pay, which most of us do not. And because I'm one of them. Then you don't call out, you go in when you're sick because you need that money.
And
so
it's not
I'm hoping that on the other end of that, we turn that around.
And don't forget also the disciplinary that you get, you could get fired for missing work. And so if you have a family who gets sick and are getting sick, you can go over sick days and get fired. So that's also included that you're afraid that you might get fired.
Exactly.
Or might pull out your vacation time and maybe you don't have any accrued. Depending what state you live in. So yeah, hopefully that goes with the being paid enough to our essential workers.
Sure.
I think we to thank all those essential workers real quick while we're here, the truckers, the grocery store workers, the healthcare, and there's a lot of you
gas
out there.
Stations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know there's people
who are delivering our stuff from Amazon, anybody in the warehouses that's sorting that stuff, people who are shipping things.
That includes you DoorDash drivers, Postmates, you guys too.
You guys, love you guys. Love you guys.
Thank you.
Love you guys. Thank you. We can't thank you enough. You're amazing people. And like I said, hopefully on the other side of this, we come out with you making more money than, you know, people who are sitting on their little high horse making their financial gains.
Yeah. And I'm hoping there's more unemployment for gig workers and stuff and self-employed. I really hope we come out.
For sure.
So yeah.
And of course, guys, as always, please feel free to reach out to us for corrections or, you know, quests or if you just want to say hi. Bree, go ahead and give the slew of social needs.
All right.
Because this is your specialty.
All right. So we would love for you to come contact us in any ways. First off, we would love it if you share us with a friend, I guess. You can listen to us at the same time. If you are in the same house already, do it. Social distancing, it's a great way to do it. Ways that you can talk to us is on Twitter at PDS Podcast. You can get us on Instagram at PDS Podcast. If you're on Facebook, we're P Dangerous Situation. And our email is the same as the Facebook. So that's P as in, wow, Brina's so pretty, dangerous situation@gmail.com. Thank you so much for hanging in. We appreciate it. And I guess we only have a few more words to say.
Duck and cover.
Yeah, duck and cover.
Woo! Thanks, PDS babe.
Yay. Bye, PDS babe.
Woo-hoo. Bye.
Bye.